Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Today's webinar on root cause analysis and systemic corrective action. My name is Shannon Craddock. I'm the Programs and Accreditations Manager here at Perry Johnson Registrars, and I'm so pleased that you carved out time today to attend today's webinar. Why this particular topic? We're also going to talk about the constituent parts of the audit finding and how a well-written audit finding sets up the problem-solving team for success. We'll be talking about corrections, containment actions, known as actions taken to correct. We'll talk about sound root cause analysis, and we'll specifically focus on the Y technique, or the 5Y technique. We'll talk about actions taken to prevent recurrence of the issue, or corrective actions. And then we'll chat about actions taken to prevent occurrence of an issue or preventive actions. And then what makes up a sound verification activity to ensure the corrective action is effective, corrections can be removed if applicable, and the problem is not recurred. So why are we doing this? Why this topic? This is one of PJR's most popular webinars, and we repeat it many times. Well, most importantly, we want your organization to improve. And there should be a strong correlation between third-party audit performance, how you do on your audits, and how you're performing in the eyes of your customers. And your performance in the eyes of your customers is really determined by on-time, on-quality product or service. The purpose of an audit, when a certification body like PJR comes in and does an audit, it's not to convince the auditor to write as few findings as possible, but it's to take systemic corrective action for each and every nonconformity that's found. And if you do this, if you really do good problem solving, find the true corrective action, implement it, verify its effectiveness, you're going to start to see the stronger correlation. There'll be less recurrence of issues. Issues may stop occurring at all. And that's where you're going to see this improvement. Okay, let's move on to the audit finding. A well-written audit finding needs to have three distinct parts. And that is the statement of nonconformity, objective evidence, and a citation of the requirement that's not being met. If you see an audit finding or a nonconformity that does not contain these three parts, they should not be written by PJR auditors, first of all, and they shouldn't be accepted by you, our clients. In fact, I'm here to tell you, you are completely empowered, and you should reject audit findings that don't contain these three parts at the closing meeting. From time to time, if it's allowed by the standard, our auditors will document opportunities for improvement. These should exist as statements or recommendations. There will not be a citation of a requirement not being fulfilled, because if a requirement was not being fulfilled, it should be documented as a nonconformity. Okay, so let's talk about that first part of a well-written nonconformity, and that's the statement of nonconformity. So we're going to focus on the first of three parts. So a typical pitfall here is that the nonconformity recorded is not the problem, but a symptom of the problem. So the problem needs to be expressed as an issue with the system. And that word is intentionally bolded there. if the problem is expressed in terms of an individual, a person, or a very specific incident, it's at the symptom stage, and we want to avoid that. And I see not only internal auditors make this mistake when I'm auditing companies, but I see some of my peers make this mistake as well. So it's important to get to the true problem, the systemic issue. There that word is, bolded again, or the problem-solving efforts won't be effective. Fixing symptoms will not stop the issue from recurring. So it's always in this part of the presentation, I talk about kind of an everyday example we can all relate to. So consider that you're not feeling well. You've got a runny nose, a sore throat, a headache, and a fever. You could take some Tylenol or Aleve and maybe bring down your fever temporarily and ease that sore throat pain. You're just addressing the symptoms of the systemic issue. Now, suppose you go to the doctor and you get diagnosed with a strep throat infection. The doctor will prescribe an antibiotic and will kill the streptococci bacteria, which is causing the infection. So in that case, taking the antibiotic addresses the systemic issue, the strep throat infection. All the Tylenol in the world isn't going to kill the strep throat bacteria. It's just going to treat your symptoms. So we really want to understand the systemic issue so we can address that. So when we're problem solving, we want to analogize it to going to the doctor and getting diagnosed with a strep throat infection so we treat that as opposed to just the symptoms, the headache, the sore throat, and the fever. Additionally, a well-written nonconformity should stand the test of time. Your organization should be able to look back at nonconformities written years ago and understand exactly what the problem was. That statement of nonconformity needs to focus on the systemic issue, and there needs to be lots of detail in parts 2 and 3 to support your understanding. So let's look at some examples that demonstrate poorly written statements of nonconformity. First is, there was no training matrix for the first shift operator running job 9954, indicating competence to run that job. Again, we're focusing on symptoms, not the true problem, not the true systemic issue. We're confusing objective evidence with the statement of nonconformity. So this is expressed in terms of a specific person, the first shift operator, and a specific incident. Okay, the time that somebody was running job 9954 and they didn't have a training matrix. A better way to rate this. The system, and you see that word there, system. The system for recording employee training and competence is not completely effective. Now, that prior sentence is now included as objective evidence. It includes details about the symptoms that assist in understanding. That's the objective evidence. There was no training matrix for the first shift operator running job 9954, indicating competence to run that job. And then there's the citation of the requirement not being met, in this case, 9001-2015-72D. You'll note we're including the revision year of the standard, and we're including the finest citation of the requirement possible. We're not just saying section 7, we're not just saying section 7.2, we're taking it all the way out to 7.2D. So a better way to write this finding, the system for recording employee training and competence is not completely effective. We're focusing on system. That word is right in the statement of nonconformity. And we're not focusing on a specific incident or person. All right, another example. Same type of pitfall. Quality auditor in the blue cell was using an uncontrolled form to record the results of first piece inspection. Again, this is a symptom of a problem, not the true systemic issue. Again, we're confusing objective evidence with a statement of nonconformity. A better way to write this. The the document control system, there's that word popping up again, is not completely effective. Now, the objective evidence to assist in understanding includes all those details about the specific person or incident, all the symptoms of the problem. Quality auditor in the blue cell was using an uncontrolled form to record the results of first piece inspection, and then a very fine citation of the requirement all the way out to 7531A of the 2015 version of 9001. So the document control system is not completely effective. This statement of nonconformity focuses on the systemic issue. We're not focusing on the symptoms of the problem or a specific incident. So in summary, when you review a statement of nonconformity written by your internal audit team, maybe even one of your customers or a PGR auditor, ask yourself, are we distinguishing between the symptoms of the problem and the true systemic issue? Does that final statement of nonconformity focus on a systemic issue? And does the auditor provide enough data, so objective evidence, all the symptoms that they saw, all the incidents that were observed, and a very clear, detailed citation of the requirement not being met to assist in understanding? And that last bullet point is really what allows a nonconformity to stand the test of time. There's sufficient detail when somebody is removed from the moment where the nonconformity is presented by years that they know exactly what happened. PGR has an internal document. It's our advisory 3. It's for our auditors only, that requires auditors to document any non-fulfillment of a requirement as such. In fact, as the author of this document, I told them it's absolutely inexcusable for them not to do so. There's no benefit for you. So when they discover a nonconformity, they should really write it up. And that gives you, that forces you to do sound problem solving, identify the root cause, and implement a corrective action. If they just let you fix it in the moment, you're not going to understand what caused the problem. You're just going to put a Band-Aid on it. There's no benefit to you. And this really contributes to the diminishment of the integrity of accredited management system certification. So it's our expectation at PGR that all nonconformities written by PGR auditors need to be documented as described. If they're not, you, our clients, are completely empowered to ask the auditor to rewrite it. Their goal is to set you up for success in your problem solving. Okay, let's pause for a moment and we're going to move on to actions taken to correct. Now, these are called corrections or containment actions. This is a fairly straightforward concept that most people do a good job with. They're actions taken with respect to the symptom or incident, and they're therefore incident-specific actions. These actions are really important and need to be taken as soon as possible to stop the symptoms from getting worse. So if we go back to our example, if your child, especially your young child, is sick and they have a very high fever, you're going to give them some type of pain reliever, fever reducer as quickly as possible to bring their fever down as you make arrangements to take them to the doctor. You're not going to wait and see if that 104-degree fever goes down. No, you're going to take action immediately to give your child some relief. Same thing here. Now, actions taken to correct typically take two forms. And the first bullet point is really what most people identify with and understand. So the finding is that the auditor found uncalibrated gauges. Your correction is we calibrated the gauge. Or the auditor found some uncontrolled documents and you controlled the documents. The second type is adding a layer of inspection to catch any further occurrence. And this is fine as a correction, but remember that inspection adds cost to the system. It doesn't add value. Later, we're going to learn that once corrective action is implemented, This costly added layer of inspection should be able to be removed from the system. Containment actions or corrections should be very specific. So let's look at the two examples we've been following throughout today's webinar. The training matrix for the first shift operator running job 9954 was updated to reflect his competency. And his competency is in fact that he can run the job unsupervised. It's a perfect containment or correction. Or all copies of the uncontrolled form the quality auditor in the blue cell was using were destroyed. Keep in mind that corrections also need to include what is known as an extent analysis or a look across. So the auditor in their audit activity may have discovered one instance or a couple instances of an uncontrolled form or an uncalibrated gauge. But how many more are there? In other words, what's the depth and breadth of the problem? So a PGR auditor may see one gauge that's out of calibration, or a single form that's uncontrolled and being used, or they may stumble upon one training record that isn't updated. So we expect you to understand the depth and breadth of the issue and address it in an extent analysis, which is part of an action taken to correct. So a properly executed and well-written extent analysis might read something like this. We verified the two gauges found by the PGR auditors, number 2458 and number 1354. Both were found to be conforming. So it looks like the PGR auditor found two gauges that by the date or the stick, the date on the sticker were past due for calibration. The organization checked these and both were found to be in a conforming state. They then state our extent analysis included 213 other gauges in our facility. So it's important to state how many other gauges were looked at. So 213 others. Therefore, I would surmise this organization has 215 total gauges in their facility. Only one, and they identify it by number 5858, was found to be out of calibration. It was calibrated and returned to service. Further, they state that no product was measured with gauge 5858 since it was last in a known state of calibration. If in fact they found product measured with 58 or verified with 5858 after it was in a known state of calibration, they would have had to potentially do a recall on that product or understand if it was the last measurement and understand the impact on the customer. So this isn't the level of detail we're looking for in a well-written extent analysis. So our nonconformity report, the PGR form, has a blank dedicated to include an extent analysis. And while use of our form is optional, many customer forms, many of our audited clients don't have a extent analysis blank on their form, and sometimes they forget to do this. So if you use your own form, make sure that within the correction section, you're including an extent analysis. Okay, let's move on to root cause analysis. The most common pitfall with root cause analysis is restating the incident as the root cause. This isn't acceptable and it happens a lot. I see this on a daily basis when I'm working with auditors and clients on rejected responses. Very common mistake. So someone will say and submit as their root cause analysis for the two examples we've been following through today's webinar. Our organization failed to update the training matrix for the operator running job 9954. And I laugh to myself and think, oh, no kidding, we already told you that. We already told you that you had an out-of-date training matrix. Doesn't match what the person was doing. We know this. We told you. You need to tell us why.
or the quality auditor in the blue cell didn't use the correct form. Once again, genius, we told you this. We brought this to your attention. You're failing to tell us why. And that's what a root cause analysis needs to do. Another pitfall, although not as common as what I just described, is that some cars restate the containment or the correction as the root cause. This is not acceptable. Okay, so if you're on social media and you've drifted away from the presentation or you're writing an email, I urge you to stop. This is the single most important slide in today's presentation. A good root cause analysis answers this question. What in the system failed such that the problem occurred? I'm going to pause for a moment and let that sink in. What in the system failed such that the problem occurred? The focus is on the system, not the incident. Now, it's possible that a problem may have multiple root causes or several possible causes. And if you're not sure of the root cause, and you perhaps narrowed it down to two, all root causes are going to require corrective action. So, if you found the root cause, you should be able to turn the problem off and then on again, just like a light switch. If you can't turn the problem on and off at will, then you haven't identified the true root cause. So I'm going to illustrate this with an example. I used to work for a large tier one automotive manufacturing organization. We supplied directly to General Motors and as well as a number of other automotive OEMs. And we were a plastic molding facility, and we had a lot of dual cavity tools. This particular part had a left hand and right hand component, and our operators kept putting the left hand part in the right hand packout box and vice versa. We were in big trouble with GM. We stopped the line. There were issues. We had to put corrections in place very quickly. In fact, we had corrections that were the added costly layer of inspection. We had a third-party sorting company come out. They were at our facility. They were at the GM assembly plant doing sorting. Tens of thousands of dollars going out the door every day. So we convened a problem-solving team. They started doing root cause analysis. And we determined that the root cause was that there was a very narrow configuration of the manufacturing cell. And instead of the left-hand packout box being on the left-hand side of the packout operator's body and the right-hand packout box being at the right-hand side of the packout operator's body, they were in line with one another. So the left-hand box was right in front of the auditor and the right-hand box was behind it. And they had to remember left hand was first, right hand was behind it. And it was just awkward, but it was because the manufacturing cell was so narrow. So we moved the press and then we had to move the manufacturing presses on either side of it. This required a re-PPAP of three manufacturing processes. A lot of work went into this. A lot of money went into this. And that helped the situation. There were fewer mixed parts, but the problem was still occurring. In other words, we hadn't turned the problem off like a light switch. We weren't able to do that. So we knew we probably didn't have the true root cause. I'll come back to that story in a moment. Now, there are a lot of different techniques for root cause. The is not technique, the fishbone or Ishikawa diagram, or the 5-Y technique. And sometimes you can get there in fewer Ys. So let's look at the examples we've been following through today's webinar. So the first nonconformity is the system for recording employee training and competence is not completely effective. The symptom we saw, no training matrix for the first shift operator running job 9954, indicating competence to run that job. Well, why was this the case? Well, the first shift operator failed to update the training matrix as required by the first of the month. Well, why did they fail to update the training matrix? Well, before the end of the previous month, HR manager would email the training matrix template to all of the supervisors, but that didn't happen this month. Well, why didn't it happen? The HR manager left the company before the end of the month and a replacement didn't email the template to all the supervisors. Well, why didn't the replacement email the template? Well, the procedure for training didn't include a requirement to prompt the new HR manager to email the template to all of the supervisors. So you'll note what I've done here is ask why over and over again. In this case, the organization felt they got to the true root cause and only four whys, which is fine. This is a bit subjective. Could you have gone further? Maybe, maybe not. But you want to have a high level of confidence that you've gone far enough in your why analysis. How do you get that confidence? Well, number one, the problem-solving team should not just be a single person, typically the management representative sitting by themselves in front of their computer 24 hours before the findings are due to PJR. It's not going to work. Make sure you include everybody that needs to be included, a multidisciplinary approach to problem solving. So people from all impacted departments. Let's look at our second example. The document control system isn't completely effective. And the symptom of this that we saw is that the quality auditor in the blue cell was using an uncontrolled form to record the results of first piece inspection. Why were they using an uncontrolled form? Listen carefully, I'm going to use the word why over and over again. Why were they using an uncontrolled form? Well, the controlled hard copies of the form had all been used in the blue cell, so the quality auditor resorted to an uncontrolled form. Well, why did they resort to an uncontrolled form? Well, the quality auditor wasn't aware that when no hard copies of a particular form were available, the latest version of all forms could be printed through the company's database. Why didn't they know this? Well, that person wasn't given a username and password to access the database. Well, why weren't they given a password and username to access the database? HR didn't have a policy to ensure all new hires are granted a system username and password. Again, this took four whys. We can have increased confidence that four whys are sufficient if we've got a number of people present in our problem-solving team, HR, maybe quality, maybe production, maybe somebody from executive management, maybe some operational employees. I always tell the story of my young kids asking if they can do something, and I say, no, you can't have a cookie before dinner. And they'll say, why? And I'll say, because, and I'll give a reason, and they'll say, well, why? And when I get to the point where they wear me down and I say, because I'm the mom and I said so, when you as a problem solving team feel like you get to that point, because I'm the mom and I said so, you can have confidence you've gone far enough. But sometimes only time will tell. Have you been able to turn the problem off like a light switch? So if we go back to that example I talked about of the manufacturing environment, we moved the presses, we reconfigured the manufacturing cell and the pack-out boxes. We still weren't able to turn the problem off like a light switch. So we reconvened our problem-solving team. We invited more people. And this time it was a third shift material handler who said, you know, if it was impossible to put a right-hand part in a left-hand box and vice versa, you wouldn't have this issue. So we worked with a staff packaging engineer to do just that. You couldn't put a left-hand part into a right-hand pack-out box because of the corrugated and the dividers. And we were able to turn the problem off like a light switch. So we knew we had the true root cause. All right, let's talk about some things we won't accept for root cause. Oversight. We misunderstood the requirement. Although to be honest, I have some tolerance for misunderstanding the requirement, but only if it's your first time working with a standard or maybe a new revision of a standard. Perhaps the way the auditor asks the question, the intent of the requirement becomes clear. We forgot one of my personal favorites, another ISO 9001 blunder. Client had four nonconformities. That was the root cause for each. Our consultant messed up or human error. Okay, let's move on to corrective actions. Corrective actions are directly correlated to the root cause. They therefore should address that very important question. What in the system failed such that the problem occurred? A common pitfall with corrective action is that many organizations will restate their correction or containment, and this is not acceptable. Corrections and containment actions are very different than corrective actions. You have to understand the difference. We already talked about correction or containment. It's to address the symptoms. It's taking Tylenol to bring down a fever. It's hiring a third-party sorting company to be on site at my former employer in General Motors to sort product and certify it as conforming. Those are containment or correction actions. Corrections. Corrective actions are directly related to the root cause. They not only address the systemic issue, but they should be irreversible. They should involve a change in the system. So a lot of times organizations will say, we're going to retrain. That's our corrective action. That's okay. But training by itself is generally not a system change. Not to mention, you probably already trained already. What's going to make this version of training more effective? And in the automotive industry, corrective actions should prompt changes to your FEMAs and control plan, and they may require a new PPAP. There needs to be at least one corrective action for each root cause that was identified. And in order to know that you have the true root cause, subsequent data should show that the problem has 100% disappeared. You've turned it off like a light switch. If you want to go further, you can recreate the defect. You can remove the corrective action from the system in a controlled environment and see if the problem recurs. Okay, so let's look at our two examples. The system for recording employee training and competence is not completely effective. Our corrective action, section 4.6 of the training procedure was updated to include a requirement for the HR manager to email the training matrix template to all supervisors at the end of the month. The new HR manager was trained and she added an automatic reminder to Outlook to perform the task. Okay, does this corrective action address the root cause? Remember, the root cause and corrective action are linked. Let's go back and see. The procedure for training didn't include a requirement to prompt the HR manager to email the template. Now that procedure training does include that prompt, There was a training component, but it's not the only component of our corrective action. And there's an automatic reminder in Microsoft Outlook. I would say this corrective action does in fact address the root cause. Let's look at our second example. The document control system is not completely effective. Corrective action. new hire work instruction was revised to include a requirement to grant new hires usernames and passwords as appropriate. HR personnel were trained on this change. You'll note this corrective action is a training component, but it's not the only component of the corrective action. There's a permanent system change, change to a work instruction. Question we need to ask, does this corrective action address the root cause? HR didn't have a policy to ensure all new hires are granted a system username and password. Now there's a new policy, the new hire work instruction being revised to include a requirement to grant new hires a username and password. This corrective action does address the root cause. So when training is part of a corrective action response, the response should also include the technique that will be used to verify training effectiveness. This is a great practice. So if you train somebody, you need to make sure that training's effective. Perhaps one thing you can do is administer an exam or a case study of similar scenarios to make sure that, in fact, that training is effective. Okay, let's talk about preventive actions. These answer one of two questions. What other systems exist that might have the same root cause present? So in the example from my former life, what other manufacturing cell configurations are poor? Or what other dual cavity tools have pack out boxes where you can put a left-hand part into a right-hand box? What systems could I have had in place that would have prevented this from happening? A lot of corrective action reports put corrective actions for preventive actions, but remember that preventive actions address the future, not the past. So what could still happen, not what did happen. Preventive actions address changes to the system. They don't address incidents. Because if an incident occurred, we'd be talking about corrective action. And they involve changing the system to prevent future problems. Keep in mind that preventive actions are not only identified because of nonconformities. Many management system standards require preventive action as a proactive process with inputs from multiple sources, like near-miss reports, 5S programs, or other lean initiatives, employee suggestions. In other words, no nonconformity should never mean no preventive actions. Okay, finally, let's talk about corrective action verification. A very critical and often not performed step to close out the problem-solving process. One reason for this is that the corrective action report doesn't have a place for verification at the appropriate location. So in a sound verification exercise, you need to look at all the following. Have we taken a containment or correction to stop the bleeding? I.e., did we take Tylenol to bring down our high fever? And if we implemented a costly added layer of inspection. I'm down at the fourth bullet point now. We've implemented a costly added layer of inspection, like hiring a third-party sorting company. We should be able to remove that. And that's because we've done a proper root cause analysis and we've turned the problem off, just like a light switch. And we've implemented an irreversible systemic corrective action. That systemic corrective action addresses the root cause. And we've also looked at opportunities for preventive action. So we've got other manufacturing cells where you can put a left-hand part into a right-hand box. All of these 5 points are considered. We have a sound verification activity. We need to keep in mind that corrective actions, while meant to be irreversible, tend to be reversible. When we're changing a system, it means we're changing the way work is performed. And we all know change is difficult. Systems tend to return to where people feel comfortable. So you want to continue to verify actions even after you get positive results on the first verification. So if you implement a new process and you train everybody and you verify the effectiveness of that training, and you come back 2 weeks later and everybody says, great, everybody's doing exactly what they're supposed to be doing, you may not want to close that corrective action on your log. Will they still be doing what they're supposed to be doing 30 days from now, 90 days from now, 180 days from now? Continue to verify actions even after you get positive results on the first verification. Essentially, what I'm telling you is you shouldn't have a KPI to close out every nonconformity on your corrective action log in 30 days. Some issues may take longer to verify. Number one, because they only happen once or twice a year. I'd like to acknowledge the IAOB for some of the slide content I presented today. And I'll now open the floor for any questions or comments. Thanks for that feedback, Carl. I appreciate your compliment. Any other questions? Again, this webinar is being recorded, and if you go to our website, www.pjr.com, you can access the slides and a recording of the presentation, and you'll be able to share that with folks in your organization. Previous versions of this webinar are also available. So you might find it helpful to listen to a different version because there's different questions at the end, and that may be helpful too. Somebody's asking what a KPI is. A KPI is a key performance indicator. Apologize for using an acronym and not the full name. So a KPI is a process measurable. So a lot of times for a corrective action process, organizations will establish KPIs that say, close issues out in 30 days. I don't agree with that KPI, Larry. I think a better KPI might be initial response in 24 hours, a full response, including root cause and corrective action in 30 days. And then you're going to get better problem solving, better results. You won't be in a rush to close things in their log, in your log, without doing sound verification. The slide deck will also be available. Okay, somebody has a great question, Jesse. Jesse said that I said inspections have costed the system. Would that include internal inspections? If so, why? So I was mainly referring to added layers of inspection, which are often done by third-party sorting companies. But sometimes companies will add an internal layer of inspection. Internal inspections are often done by humans, and they're never 100%, so that's going to add cost to the system. Long-term, you're better looking at error-proofing, detection devices on machinery that allow good parts to consistently be made. Understanding, though, that some of those things, Jesse, are cost-prohibited, so you may need to have some internal in process and final inspections. I'm saying, can multiple root cause analysis techniques be used in one investigation? I mean, it's possible. Some companies may use different techniques to see if they get the root cause. I can tell you consistently at PGR, we use the 5-Y technique. Getting more questions coming in. Multiple legged 5-Ys that focus on technical and detection root causes are really helpful, Dondra. And they're, I think, a more sophisticated version of the Y technique that I talked about. If your organization is at that level, that's fantastic. I would recommend continuing to choose that. If you're newer and struggle with problem solving and submitting good causes, let's just focus on the Y technique. But yeah, that multiple-legged 5-Y is fine. Okay, so somebody's talking about what if we're, you know, working in an area where the error comes down to employee negligence. We've got good processes and policies. The error comes down to employee negligence. So you certainly can have good policies, good work instructions. You need to be considering if your processes are allowing bad product to be made that the operators aren't catching in their negligence. So I'd ask you to consider error proofing, and then maybe you need to take a look at the employee. I think there's a difference between an employee being recalcitrant, intentionally negligent, or employees simply not catching things and being well-intended because the system allows bad product to be made. That's to address your question, Austin. Okay, Willie has a great question. 9001-2015, remove preventive action and introduce the concept of risk. In some of our contracts, they're requiring risk. Are we saying the same thing if we say risk instead of preventive action? Yeah, I mean, essentially, the introduction of risk and it replacing corrective action, preventive action, I'm very sorry, is really that they want you to consider all the risks associated within all processes. So I think including the concept of risk really broadened or made the concept more global. Because with preventive actions, a lot of companies had tunnel vision. When there was a non-conforming situation, they looked for preventive action opportunities. Now they're asking you, even before you accept a contract, have you considered all that can go wrong, all the risks to the situation, from the beginning of the life cycle to the end of the life cycle? So the beginning being, can you properly source the raw materials? Especially in today's times, can you get the semiconductors that you need? Can you get sufficient staff to make the product? Do you have the machinery and equipment in place? Do you have the technology? Do you have the knowledge to make this product? Are there shipping delays? All of those things need to be considered. It's a much broader concept. Jonathan's asking, our company was audited by our customer, and I guess the customer auditor does not like the inspection time tracking in your inspection process. Can they write a non-conformance? I'm not sure I understand your question, Jonathan. It looks like you have a requirement for your inspectors to log the time they took doing the inspection. To me, that's not a non-conformity. It sounds like you're trying to do a time study. I don't know. You may want to restate your question or add clarification. Tim's got a great point. A supervisor submits a labor shortage as a root cause. Should the root cause be denied or passed to HR? A labor shortage could very well be a valid root cause. I know many organizations coming out of the pandemic are still struggling with staffing and getting good people to come to work. So I think now more than ever in 2023, that's a valid root cause. Folks, be sure to watch our website, www.pjr.com, for new and exciting webinars coming up in the future. I know we have a ton coming up in the summer months, so be sure to continually peruse that list to see if there's any topics that are of interest to you. Okay, it looks like I've answered all the questions. I don't see any new questions coming in. Appreciate your time today. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you found this webinar helpful.